Kim Jong-un should take heed of the United Nations Security Council's unified voice.
North Korea detonates an apparent hydrogen bomb. It's Monday, September 4th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, members of BRICS nations meet to chart an economic path forward. Australia looks at gay marriage. India's prime minister shuffles his cabinet. Time for technology and Labor Day in the USA. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis says any threat by North Korea to the United States or its allies will be met with a massive military response, both effective and overwhelming. Mattis spoke outside the White House Sunday after he and other top advisors met with President Donald Trump on North Korea's apparently successful test of a hydrogen bomb.
Any threat to the United States or its territories, including Guam, or our allies, will be met with a massive military response, a response both effective and overwhelming. Kim Jong-un should take heed of the United Nations Security Council's unified voice. All members unanimously agreed on the threat North Korea poses, and they remain unanimous in their commitment to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Because we are not looking to the total annihilation of a country, namely North Korea.
In earlier Twitter remarks, Trump called North Korea a rogue nation whose words and actions continue to be very hostile and dangerous to the United States. The U.S. leader said North Korea has become a great threat and an embarrassment to China, which is trying to help but with little success. The U.N. Security Council has called for an emergency meeting later today on the situation in Korea. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the test as profoundly destabilizing for regional security. International Atomic Energy Agency Director General Yukiya Amano says Pyongyang needs to comply with all existing UN resolutions.
Today's nuclear test by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea is an extremely regrettable act. This new test, which follows the two tests last year and is the sixth since 2006, is in complete disregard of the repeated demands of the international community. In its resolutions, most recently in 2371, the Security Council has reaffirmed its decisions that the DPRK shall not conduct any further nuclear tests and shall abandon all nuclear weapons and existing nuclear programs in a complete, verifiable, an irreversible manner.
President Trump said earlier he is considering halting all trade with any country doing business with North Korea and has not ruled out a retaliatory strike. The North claimed its test of a hydrogen bomb small enough to be carried by an intercontinental ballistic missile was a perfect success. The blast reportedly shook buildings in China and Russia. If true, Tom Plant, Director for Proliferation and Nuclear Policy at RUSI, says it's a technological game changer.
Many questions came up this morning on what's the next step. I think the next step is where we are today is that the Security Council has dealt with many sanctions, and the sanctions seem to not be stopping the DPRK from going beyond the acceptable in terms of their nuclear weapon program. Where do we go? It's probably a $1 million question, but I think many of the states today in their remark have urged for political and diplomatic solution to this problem.
Lassina Zerbo, the executive secretary of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization, talking about the best course of action not being clear. One U.S. intelligence official says there was no reason to doubt North Korea's claim that it detonated a nuclear bomb Sunday that was 10 times more powerful than one that it tested a year ago. Once again, Tom Plant.
The step is technologically quite significant. I mean, they've made a technological advance that people were expecting them to make at some point, but not this quickly. If it is indeed true, that is, that they've tested a thermonuclear weapon, and we should wait to see really the final verdict on whether that has happened. It does look likely at this stage.
Any U.S. call for an economic boycott of countries doing business with North Korea could quickly hinder the nearly $650 billion in annual trade between the United States and China, because Beijing is North Korea's sole major ally and its biggest trading partner. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said he would prepare a new package of North Korea economic sanctions for consideration. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Emmanuel Macron said Pyongyang reached a new dimension of provocation with the test. They called for tougher European sanctions against North Korea and new penalties imposed by the United Nations Security Council. We invite you to read more on our top story by following VOA Asia on Facebook and the voanews.com website. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. Trump calls North Korea a rogue nation after its sixth nuclear test. Possible two-stage hydrogen bomb seen as game-changer for North Korea. Xi Jinping says BRICS nations should stand up against protectionism. Khmer Rouge-era rape cases remain taboo topic, justice elusive for survivors. Racist place names in Australia to be wiped from maps. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and also the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Leaders of the world's largest emerging economies, the so-called BRICS nations of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, are gathered for a summit in the Chinese city of Xiamen. Since their first summit in 2009, members have formed their own development bank, and China launched its One Belt, One Road infrastructure initiative. But underlying the meeting is the persistent rivalry between the two most populous countries, China and India. Both countries resolved a recent border dispute, but tensions remain over India's sanctuary of Tibet's spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, recent Chinese military exercises in the Indian Ocean, China's close ties to Pakistan, and New Delhi's improving ties with Washington. Scott Kennedy, who directs the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Washington-based Center of Strategic and International Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the two objectives he sees is the ability of China and India to overcome tensions and an effort to broaden the agenda of this young multilateral organization. Is BRICS an effort to replace Western financial institutions?
I don't think we ought to see the BRICS group as an alternative to the G7 or G20 or the Bretton Woods system. I do think it is an effort by China and these others to have a higher global profile, to have an organization that represents a large proportion of the world's population and GDP that doesn't include the United States. But substantively, there's still lots of differences between these countries. Their political systems are different as well. So far, it is more symbolism than a real significant challenge.
Scott, a professor at the Center for East Asian Studies at the Jawaharlal Nehru University, said the timing of this summit is significant, coming as the U.S. under President Trump appears to be abandoning the traditional global order.
This is the fifth summit, and so it's been going on, you know, for several years. I think there is a question about the U.S.'s role globally. And what we are seeing as a consequence of the new administration's policies is a lot more self-help activity by countries around the world, countries willing to take more risks, and other organizations that are acting together, standing out in contrast to American behavior. Those are things to be concerned about. The solutions are a more active, engaged United States, not pushing China to be less involved globally.
You mentioned India-China tensions, of course, regarding India's hosting of the Tibetan spiritual leader, as well as their most recent border tension. Are these tensions going to predominate? Do you think this will be a good forum for them to ease those tensions?
My guess is that during the BRICS summit, they're going to paper over these differences. They are quite significant. They're reflective of broader strategic differences, different views about Tibet and political systems, but they're not going to get through this weekend, you know, trying to solve these things. I think they're going to try and put those aside for the moment, put on a good face. But when this is over, they will have the same problems that they did face. And I think that's why people shouldn't put too much into the BRICS as an organization with a big mission. I think it's still grasping for one, and it may always be in that state.
Scott Kennedy said while the BRICS nations agree on broad themes of development, infrastructure improvements and fairness in climate policies differ in many ways. South Africa, Brazil, and India are imperfect democracies, and all five have different security interests. He said as much as divides them as unites them, and expectations of achievements at the summit will likely remain modest. Happening now in Asia, Cambodian opposition leader Kem Sokha was arrested earlier Sunday on an espionage charge, accused of conspiring with a foreign power to harm the country. Human rights activists say Sokha's arrest has taken the ongoing crackdown of the opposition by Cambodia's ruling party to an alarming new level. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thanks for listening. Australia plans to hold a non-binding postal survey this month to gauge support for changing its Marriage Act to include same-sex couples. Campaigning on the change has already begun, and it's already divisive and controversial. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports while the case is challenging the survey and scheduled to be heard in Australia's High Court for the coming days.
School told my son he could wear a dress next year if he felt like it.
When same-sex marriage passes as law overseas, this type of program becomes widespread and compulsory.
Opponents of marriage reform in Australia are making their case in an advert shown online and on television. In it, they claim that should same-sex couples be allowed to marry, there would be serious consequences for children, who would then be exposed to radical views on homosexuality in schools. Lyle Sheldon is from the Coalition for Marriage.
We want Australians to see the consequences that occur when the law around marriage has changed. This is what's occurred overseas. Parents had rights before the law was changed. After the law was changed, their rights to have their children free from compulsory radical LGBTIQ sex education was taken away.
The only young people affected by marriage equality are young gay people who for the first time will have the same dignity as everyone else in our country. And they deserve that.
The Equality Campaign is urging Australians to support marriage reform. It believes the majority of voters believe same-sex couples should be allowed to wed. Spokesperson Karen Phelps says the No campaign advert is hurtful.
The Australian community is now seeing these crazy messages about the implications of marriage equality. And to be honest, I think that the ads are dishonest. I think that they are victimising vulnerable children. And I think that the Australian community deserves a response.
Advocates for reform say the proposed postal survey is an act of weakness by the centre-right Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, who supports same-sex marriage but has been forced to placate powerful right-wing factions in his government. Next week, Australia's High Court will hear a case arguing that the postal vote is illegal. The complainants say that Australia's Bureau of Statistics, and not the government, is responsible for collecting statistical data. They also question whether the government is allowed to spend $97 million on the postal survey without the approval of the federal parliament. If the survey goes ahead, the final result is expected in mid-November. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
The This news alert from VOA Asia, the eldest grandchild of Japanese Emperor Akihito is getting married. Princess Mako and her college sweetheart Kai Komuro announced their engagement Sunday in a televised news conference. Mako will lose her royal status when she marries Commoner Komuro. She was never in line to ascend the throne. Visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. India Prime Minister Narendra Modi appointed a woman as a defense minister on Sunday as he reorganized his cabinet in an effort to deliver on key pledges ahead of general elections due in a year and a half. Nirmala Sitharaman will be the first woman to handle the important portfolio in 35 years. India's former Prime Minister Indira Gandhi had also held a change of the defense ministry. Sitharaman, a 58-year-old former junior commerce minister, takes charge at a time when India's tensions with both its northern neighbors, China and Pakistan, have been running high. She is credited with being tough, efficient, and articulate. She is the second woman to hold a top post in the cabinet. Sushma Swaraj is the country's foreign minister. Modi has inducted 9 new ministers as he focuses on improving governance during the remaining 1.5 years of his term. Although Modi retains his popularity, the economy has flagged to its slowest pace in 3 years, and critics accuse him of failing to fulfill key promises made when he swept to power in 2014, pledging to create a new India. Political analysts say Modi is under pressure to make more progress on key initiatives that he's taken to grow India's economy and create millions of jobs for young people. Our thanks to Anjana Pasricha, New Delhi, for sending us this story. Authorities in the Indian city of Mumbai have called off a rescue operation after a 3-story building came crashing down on its residents, killing at least 33 people and injuring dozens more. Rescuers pulled what they believe were the final bodies from the rubble Friday, with children as young as 20 days among the dead. Top stories and interesting features to share are on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, we introduce a new segment to be heard each week on our program from VOA Asia's David Bird.
Hi everyone, I'm David Bird in Washington, and this is Time for Technology. Recently, some countries have announced they will ban the sale of gas and diesel-powered cars by 2040. Meanwhile, engineers are working to make hybrid and electric cars more attractive. Researchers, led by Matt Barth at the University of California, Riverside, say that mileage could be improved with better onboard computers.
What we're doing and proposing is not only look at the sensor data on the vehicle, but look at data also outside. So traffic data, traffic signal data, and also looking at patterns and how people drive.
Barth says that better, more powerful algorithms could analyze a driver's habits to make cars switch between gasoline and electric power.
I mean, I would think it's probably 3 to 5 years out, simply because the data exists, the communication capability exists. It's really just putting more smarts on the vehicle that can take advantage of that information.
Researchers say that better algorithms could improve fuel efficiency of hybrid cars by more than 30%. You know, our planet is mostly water, but the Pacific Institute says more than 2 million tons of waste will be poured into the world's water every day. Some Swiss researchers have developed a swimming robot that can patrol waterways and stop pollution at its source. The robot looks like a collection of segments, and researcher Jan Rolof Vandermeer of the University of Lausanne says the snake-like robot will be able to patrol waterways on its own, looking for pollution.
Like, we have a module here that measures very general water quality parameters, temperature, conductivity, for example. We also have one for pH and for oxygen levels. What we also like to achieve is that the robot by itself can find the source of a pollution. And in that way, it would have to be able to measure locally and then decide where to go next. And that is obviously a very challenging project.
Vandermeer says the researcher's ultimate goal is to create a full-time, autonomous, pollution-sniffing robot. He acknowledges that will be a big challenge, but overcoming it could have long-lasting effects on the world's environment. To learn more about these stories, log on to our webpage, voanews.com. To see video versions, visit our Facebook page, VOA Asia. For Time for Technology, I'm David Byrd.
And we have a few more new features coming your way this week. Listen each day on VOA Asia. Labor Day is being celebrated today in the United States, Monday, September 4th. It was originally a celebration of the dignity of work. The observance gradually evolved into a long weekend celebrating the unofficial end of summer. VOA's Nicoletta Illich reports on an exhibit at the National Museum of American History that portrays working Americans over the last 250 years.
The exhibit, entitled American Enterprise, starts with the merchant era, which covers the 1770s to the 1850s.
There were fur trappers, there were farmers, and artisans and merchants, and all of them worked pretty closely together.
Trade developed when the fur trappers living in the Midwest would sell their furs 800 kilometers to the south in exchange for the goods they wanted.
This then is very different from artisans in the East Coast, where they were working initially in their homes and in their small shops behind their homes. They produced goods and they sold them to people they knew, to neighbors.
Eventually, those goods were made in factories. Industrialization changed workers' lives. Curator Peter Liebold organized a part of the exhibit dealing with the corporate era from the 1860s to the 1930s.
It really covers the period where workers are moving from rural areas as farmers into cities as industrial workers. So it's this real major transformation in the nature of work.
While farmers and artisans had control over their own lives, says Liebold, they lost that control in factories. As the nation industrialized and owners and managers became more powerful, there were always conflicts. Investors wanted a bigger piece of the pie, while the workers fought for greater benefits.
The only tradition in the United States is the tradition of no traditions, that throughout the history of the country, people have had very strong opinions, and nobody ever wins.
The biggest companies at that time, like Carnegie Steel, Standard Oil, and Ford Motor, employed tens of thousands of workers.
Factories got bigger, more specialized machinery. The work that any individual did became much narrower. So instead of a skilled worker that did all phases of operation, the workers became cogs in a machine.
The work was completely depersonalized as factories became the norm. But innovation, says Liebold, is one of the keys to American history.
The nation has been very quick to continue to change. That as one technique is mastered, new techniques come up and the old ones are left behind.
In the consumer era, between the 1940s and 1970s, consumers were encouraged by advertisers to buy more goods and services.
The nature of work does start to change in the latter part of the 1800s and quickly in the 1900s with the rise of retail, with the rise of service sector jobs.
In the 1980s, women started playing a broader role in the U.S. economy, and the new global era arrived.
National borders ceased to be less important, and being able to trade around the world becomes very important. The workforce itself becomes much more mobile.
Today, some Americans are questioning the idea of globalization, and experts are debating whether it will continue or nations will put up trade barriers and retreat into smaller manufacturing and consumption patterns in the future. For Voice of America, Nicoletta Illich.
Labor Day is quite a fascinating holiday, more so than you would think. You've been listening to VOA Asia. We thank you for joining us, especially all of our listeners in Myanmar who have listened via Facebook on VOA Burmese. Thank you so much. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Aiden Utku, managing editor Diane Gao, David Bird and Ali Ogden on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.